And good evening. This is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. You know, I feel very blessed because I get to interview such amazing people, and I'm very honored to be interviewing Neil Donald Walsh this evening. A little nervous, but I'm very honored. Neil arrived on the spiritual scene and moved quickly into the larger community by making the New York Times bestsellers list with his Conversations with God series. Albeit controversial, as I discovered accidentally when I innocently gave his book to a few of my friends. However, Neil has continued to write simple and soul-lifting books for the last 14 years. We even got to follow his own personal journey on the big screen. And I personally credit Neil with being instrumental in guiding my own journey, and I had the pleasure of meeting you in a small setting 13 years ago in Toronto. Welcome, Neil.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here with you.
Mm-hmm. So, I have to ask, how controversial was the book titled Happier Than God? How much flack did you receive from that?
None whatsoever. People tend to leave me alone. I think they either marginalize me, imagining that I'm not having any really major impact on anybody, and that they probably would do better to ignore me rather than give me the benefit of more energy and more publicity. or they actually agree with me, one of the two. But I don't really get a lot of flack or conflict from anyone. I don't get a lot of negative energy about anything that I do, and I certainly didn't get anything on the book Happier Than God. Nothing but positive reaction and positive response. People seem to love the book. It has some wonderful message in it, and I've gotten some very wonderful feedback from those who have read it.
Well, I think it's a great little book, and it's all about personal creation. And for anyone who's followed The Secret, you need to get this book to understand the other laws that surround the law of attraction. And for those who've tried to create, like we are told, may have discovered the blocks that prohibit them from creating what they want in this simple yet powerful book. You know, one of the things I really like about all of your books is they seem to be, you know, very simple. We seem to complicate everything within our lives. And we certainly find our spiritual journey to be just as complicated as any of the other journeys that we're on. But, you know, your books have always been, you know, very clear, very simple, and yet very profound.
Well, thank you for saying that. I must say I feel very honored and humbled that I have received such wonderful inspiration through the years. I don't have a great deal of book learning. I didn't graduate from college. In fact, I didn't get through my second year. So I don't have a lot of academics behind me. But I have been blessed with inspiration, the ability to formulate ideas and to express thoughts in ways that people are able to embrace and capture and apply as tools in their everyday life. Honestly, I don't know where that comes from. As a practical matter, if I get impractical about it, I say I'm having conversations with God, as we all are. So we really get to a larger question. Where does creativity flow from? Where did Poe find his poetry? Where did Mozart find his music? Where did Michelangelo find his breathtaking art? And for that matter, where did Neil Donald Walsh find the words for his books? And I think it all comes from the self-same fountain of creativity, which is divinity itself, expressed individually in each of us as who we are.
Hmm. Yes. You say the energy of attraction is the product of divine love. And, you know, the power to live and the power to love is really, you know, to produce more, to produce more of everything that we love and everything that we want to live in our life. So tonight, we're going to sort of start at the end. But, you know, you really need to get this book to understand fully how to personally create and how to be happier than God. So we're going to start with, you know, the 17 steps to being happier than God, which is the first one is about ending this separation theology. Talk about that a bit, because we certainly have been dogmaed to death, I think.
Yes, we we have indeed, and we have been telling ourselves now for many years, a cultural story of separation. And that story has, in most recent times, and by recent I mean the past several thousand years, as opposed to this past several hundred thousand, mm-hmm. in the past several thousand years, that cultural story has emerged through the device that we have called religion. And religion tells us that we are separate from God. It's what I call separation theology. It says, most religions say, God is over here and you are over there. And your job is to find a way to return to God. You are separate from God. You have been made separate from God through a variety of situations and circumstances and for a variety of reasons. And your job on the earth is to somehow find your way back home, as it were, and get back to God, or if you wish, in some theological constructions, to go to heaven. Well, that's okay as far as it goes. If it just ended there, then fair enough. So far, so good. Each of us have our own beliefs, so we can let it go at that. Unfortunately, a separation theology produces a separation cosmology. Mm-hmm. That is a cosmological way of looking at things that emerges from a separation theology, a cosmological way of holding life that says the cosmology of life, that is the construction of life, is separate, a series of separate individual elements, connected but not necessarily united, that is individuated aspects but not united aspects of life itself. Mm-hmm. And that separation cosmology has produced a separation sociology. That is, a way of socializing with each other on the earth that says, I'm over here, and you're over there. And when our interests match, we will perhaps cooperate. But when they don't, we may have to find ourselves in conflict. I may even have to kill you in order to get what I think I need. And that separation sociology produces a separation pathology. That is, pathological behaviors of self-destruction, evidenced everywhere we look on the earth today. So if it were just a matter of separation theology, it wouldn't be so bad. As I said, you can walk your path, I'll walk my path. But unfortunately, such a theology, such a thought, has a fallout that creates cosmologies, sociologies, and pathologies that produce life in the world today as we know it. Therefore, the first of the 17 steps to being happier than God is to eliminate any thought of a separation theology, to embrace a brand new idea, at least new to some people, mm-hmm. of God and the world, an idea that says that there's no separation of anything from anything, that we truly are a single being manifesting itself and individuating itself in many, many different ways, but in no way separate from each other, any more than the fingers on your hand are separated from the hand itself. Even though all the fingers are decidedly different and individuated from one another.
Wow. And often we're told, instead of not only is it over there, it's up there, so we even have this chasm that we have to try and find a way to get up to the place that we need to be. You also talk about that we are God-godding, and I really like that, because that phrase really talks about how we are really, I guess really our own divinity, and that we are recreating God's self, because that's truly what we're doing. It's not so much trying to find a way up or find a way over, it's to find that's within.
Yes, I think that's the key for sure for all human beings everywhere, to really understand who we are and why we're here, and that who we are is, as I just mentioned, an individuated aspect of divinity itself. And why we're here is to create, through the miracle of physicalization, the relative experience of our true identity. That is, we are God-godding. If God wants to know itself as generous, kind, compassionate, caring, understanding, good, joyful, creative, or any of the other wonderful aspects of divinity, the only way that God could know that would be to remove its activity, its conscious experience, from the realm of the absolute, where all those things exist absolutely, to the realm of the relative, where all those things exist relative to each other. Or to put it in simple terms, you can shine a flashlight into the sun, and you will not see the flashlight. If you want to experience yourself as the light, you need to turn the flashlight out into outer space, into the darkness, and then you will see the light. So humanity is now being invited to see the light in the really literal sense, and to notice that it is an aspect of God guiding divinity, being divine, in a world of relativity where divinity can in fact experience and know itself, because the opposite of that which is divine exists. In the realm of the absolute, of course, it does not exist, and therefore you're shining a flashlight into the face of the sun.
And you also bring the very relevant point about how if we raise the collective consciousness of humanity, God also evolves, because we're all one. So as we evolve, the aspect that is the core gets to evolve as well.
Well, you know, that is correct, and that is a fundamental underpinning of the new spirituality, which is not taught in most religion schools, in most catechism classes, in the churches, synagogues, and temples of the world. We are not told of a God who itself is in the process of evolving through the process by which we evolve. But in fact, I have come to understand that is precisely what is going on. Indeed, it's the purpose of human life. That human life exists, as does life everywhere, as the vehicle and the tool through which God itself evolves and becomes the next grandest version of itself. And so we have an opportunity, each and every one of us, to play an individual role in that process. And as we move through that process, we enlarge and expand the consciousness of God itself. Therefore, we really are God-godding, not just being God, but deciding what God is going to next be as we both experience and exemplify, embody and express the process of evolution itself. The biggest mistake that we make in most human theologies is assuming that God is finished evolving. That is, God is a static entity existing somewhere in the universe, presumably in outer space or someplace, we don't know exactly where, but that God is finished with itself. And the news, the good news, is that God is not finished with itself, but that God, as is all of life, is in the process of evolving. We are the evolutionary engine of divinity itself. Not many people hold life that way, but I do.
I like to say that I'm there with you. I don't always embrace it all the time, because I think sometimes we get caught up in the everyday stuff, especially at times like this. But I certainly embrace everything that you're saying. So number two, stay in touch with who you are. You and God are one.
Yeah, that is a very, very important tool in becoming happier than God. And you just mentioned just a second ago how difficult and challenging that can be in everyday life, because we do get caught up in everyday life and we forget who we really are. The challenge, therefore, for human beings is to remember who they really are and stay in touch with that. Now, a thinking person would say, okay, great, how do you do that? And the fastest way to stay in touch with who you really are is to put someone else in touch with who they really are. That's something I've learned in my conversations with God, which is why I continue to do my work in the world. Ultimately, and in the end, the work that I do in the world is not for other people, it's for me.
Nice. You know, you talk a lot about individuation of divinity and how, you know, we're all very unique, and that's truly what it is. And, you know, I have another author who talks about, you know, how we're all diamonds, and, you know, the outer exterior of us, you know, is all so different, and that every diamond, there's no diamond that's the same, yet the core is always the same. And I just love that analogy of how we are individuations of divinity. And it's you've already spoken of it, but it's a big concept that I don't think everybody truly gets.
Well, I agree with you. fortunately, programs such as yours, and if you please, books such as mine, will help people bridge that gap and get them there much faster than they might otherwise have gone. So I really appreciate having the opportunity to share this day with you, this time with you.
Thank you. So number three, and that's what you just spoke about, but you know that as we give to others, every experience you seek. So to give, you need to give to receive. And I think, you know, as you said, it was a big revelation, and I think it really is. You know, we often think about all the things that we want, and we get caught up in the everyday stuff, and we're not just, we become almost transfixed on not being able to get what we want, because we're so focusing on the lack of what we want instead of what we have, you know, what we do have. And I think sometimes I think it's very confusing to say, you know, if you give, you get to receive, especially when it comes to, you know, if you're looking for monetary abundance, you know, how do you give if you don't have anything? So therefore, you're never going to get that. But, you know, it's more about being open and more about learning how to, you know, really remain open so that you can give love and receive love, so that you can, you know, really embrace that concept, but delve into it a little bit more so people understand.
Well, I think that what flows through you sticks to you.
Yeah.
That's why number three is so important. It says essentially that as you give to others, you give to yourself, because you're really a magnet. But however, it's difficult to call it down, to call it forth just for ourselves, because it's difficult to defeat our own thought that we're not worthy of it. See, I have no doubt that you're worthy of all the good gifts that life has to offer. And that's true of my brothers and sisters and my friends across the street and the folks around the corner. I really see everyone, in fact, as worthy except the guy in the mirror, which is the irony of life. So I will be much more able to bring prosperity, compassion, health, you know, wisdom, understanding, patience, kindness, forgiveness, all the great gifts of life, both material and non-material, to the guy across the street than I can for myself. And that's why we say in Happier Than God, the fastest track is to do unto others as you would have it done unto you. Because I can sit here and treat for my own abundance. I can, you know, use the law of, you know, the great law of attraction and so forth, the secret, if you please, all I want, and I may or may not be successful. But I know that I can produce abundance for you. I know that I can produce kindness and goodness and caring for you. I know that I can produce those things for other people. I spent my whole life doing it. I mean, working is doing that. When I go to work, I don't have a job now these days. I have self-employed, if you will, but I spent 30 years in the workforce. And when I was going to work every day, I was bringing someone else abundance. I know how to do that very well. So I was using my talents to make someone else wealthy. And I did it for quite a while, I might add. So I don't resent it. It's just how the world works.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is that when I found out the formula of how it really all works, do unto others as you would have it done unto you, suddenly the world made sense to me again. And that's when my life really began to take off. If I want to experience more wisdom, cause another to experience themselves as being more wise. If I want to experience more compassion, cause another to experience compassion in their life. And likewise, write down the list of desires on my Christmas wish list, whatever it is I want for myself, cause another to have it in their experience. And to that degree, I will have it also, for what moves through me sticks to me.
I like that. Number four, be clear that nothing you see is real.
That's a difficult one. That's a highly metaphysical thought, but it has a basis in pure science. If you read a book called The Holographic Universe, which is a kind of a science book reading, not a spiritual book, it's called The Holographic Universe by Michael Talbot, it will amaze you at what quantum physics is now unveiling and revealing to the human race. And one of the things that quantum physics tells us is that you're not seeing what you're looking at. That is, what you're looking at is not what's really there. And that if we looked at the world at large through holographic eyes, we would see just a bunch of molecular constructions, energy patterns, if you please, moving around. And what we've done is taken the energy patterns through our eyes and used our mental process to arrange the patterns in familiar forms that we call person, car, spoon, knife, fork, or whatever the other objects of life happen to be. And what the statement number four seeks to say is that none of that is real. It's just stuff you've chosen to call it. Even the names aren't real, for heaven's sake. We call it one thing in one language and one thing in another. And so we really are living in kind of a matrix. We really are down the rabbit hole where the Mad Hatter is standing there, you know, pouring tea into a cup with no bottom, telling us that what is so is not so, and that what is not so is so. So, well, it's really been helpful for me to understand that nothing I see is real. That is, nothing has any reality except the reality that I give it. By the way, that's provable. Two people can stand on one side of the street and observe the exact same event on the other side of the road and have two entirely different experiences of that event. That's been proven over and over and over again. It's called the Rashomon effect. Rashomon was a wonderful play written in Japan about 35 years ago about six men who saw a crime in the park. And they were called by the police to testify, and they had six different versions of what happened. So one person thought it was self-defense, the other person thought it was this, the other person thought it was an accident, you know, just and the police couldn't make heads or tails of it. It's called the Rashomon effect. And so what we notice is that the world that we're looking at is not real. It only is what we say it is. Or, as Shakespeare said, nothing is evil, lest thinking make it so. This is very important. This is not a small piece of how to be happier than God. When I realize that what I'm looking at is not real, the meaning it has is the meaning I give it. I think that statement's made somewhere in the Course in Miracles. I'm not sure, but I think it says somewhere in the Course, the meaning of everything is the meaning you give it. Well, that's an incredibly freeing piece of information. What a piece of data! If that were true, and by the way, it is, then my experience of life is totally and utterly within my control.
Yeah.
I can therefore experience waiting in line at the bank as a pain in the tail, or I can experience it as a wonderful opportunity to just breathe and relax for 6 or 8 minutes while the line slowly moves me to the front and to slow down a little bit in the rush and tumble of everyday life. All depends on how I want to look at it. All depends on where I'm standing, what hill I'm standing on. That's called perspective. Perspective creates perception. Perception creates belief. Belief creates behavior. Behavior creates experience. And experience creates your reality. And surprisingly, your reality creates your next perspective. It's a circle.
Hmm. Wow. Do you have a little book that's right beside you? Because you're doing really well in this.
No, I don't have anything here. I'm speaking from my mind.
Wow. You know, the one area that you talk about also in this number four is one that I know a lot of people have difficulty with, but the way we respond and react is entirely under our control. And
You know, I'm writing a book about that specifically.
Really?
Yeah, it's called When Everything Changes, Change Everything. And the book is coming out in May.
Nice.
And it deals exactly with that specific topic. 17 chapters on that alone.
Wow.
We can alter our experience and alter our reality. It talks about the line of causality that moves like this. An event happens. We witness the event. Could be an interior or an exterior event. Could be something that's happening to us or to somebody else. Doesn't matter. It's an event. An event in time and space occurs. That's the first element on the line of causality. Immediately after we witness that event, we move into our data bank. We pull up a memory of a similar event that we've had in our life. And if we can't find anything that's directly related, we'll find the next closest similarity. Anything that looks even a little bit like what we're looking at now. And that comparison will be the data that forms our truth about the present event. So we move from event to data to truth. And from that truth that we hold will emerge a thought. By the way, this all happens lightning quick. This happens in 1/1,000,000th of a second. That's how fast the mind is. And we'll get it. We'll have a thought about it. And our thought is based on our truth, which in turn is based on our past data, which in turn is based on the event itself, which just presented itself to us. From that thought will emerge an emotion. An emotion will arise from the thought that we have about the event that we're seeing. And that emotion will produce an experience. It, in the end, turns out that feelings produce experiences, not abstractions, not concepts, not ideas, but feelings. In the end, it turns out that feelings are the powerful engine of creation, and that emotion, which is energy in motion, E plus motion, that emotion is what creates our experience. And our experience creates our reality. Here's what's interesting about the line of causality. The line of causality moves from event to data to truth to thought to emotion to experience to reality. But it gets tricky because the truth that we have could be one of three kinds of truth. As we step into the supermarket of life, there on the shelf in front of us are three brands of truth. There's what I call the imagined truth. There's the apparent truth, and there's the actual truth. And which of those three truths we embrace will be decided by which data we extract from our data bank about what we're looking at. Will we extract judged past data or factual past data? I'll give you an example. Let me give you an example. Your wife or your husband, your spouse, walks out the door and slams the door and says, I'm out of here forever. You've lost me. Goodbye. Don't look. Send my things to Chicago. I'm leaving. Judged past data will bring up in that moment every experience of abandonment we ever had in our life, including when we were 6 weeks old in the crib. And mommy walked away when we were crying, trying to get her attention. And we will have judgments about that. That is, experiences that we have judged to be good or not so good. And if we have experienced those moments to be not so good, all of that data will come forward to this moment. And we experience this as a disaster, a calamity. Our spouse has just left. Oh, my God. On the other hand, factual past data simply says a human being has walked out the door and has said he's not returning. That's what's happened. Mm. Nothing else has happened. That's what's happened. Now, if we respond with a truth that's based in our judged past data, we are very likely to fall into what I call imagined truth. That is, our truth will be imagined. We'll start making up stories. Oh, my God, he'll never come back. How will I survive? I can't get by. I can't live without him. And then the kids are going to be destroyed in my eyes. Oh, well. And we get really, really caught up. It doesn't even occur to us, by the way, that this might be the best thing that ever happened to us. We can't even think that far because our imagination does not allow us, by the way, to think of positive outcomes. Very rare. Mostly the imagined data will be negative outcomes because it's the job of the mind to protect us from repeating painful experiences. So, of course, we'll do everything to stop another painful experience from occurring, including run after the guy down the street. Don't leave, John. Don't leave. I'll do anything. Even though our experience has proven that 2/3 of the bad things that happened to us that we thought were the worst things in our lives have actually turned out for the better when all was said and done. Our life experience doesn't matter. We still go to imagine past data in the present moment almost every single time. Now, when we come from imagined past data, in which we imagine the worst of all possible outcomes, we produce an imagined truth, which produces a thought, which results in an emotion, which creates an experience, which places into the space of our life a reality. That reality is either going to be a distorted reality, or an observed reality, or the ultimate reality. And what the book talks about that I'm writing now is how to get to the ultimate reality by moving to the actual truth rather than the imagined truth about whatever is occurring in your life. Now, here is the actual truth, which you touched on a few moments ago. Nothing changes except for the better. All change is for the better. We only imagine that it's for the worse. And then we get in there to prove ourselves right, and we make it for the worse by the thoughts that we have, the emotions that we express, and the experiences that we produce. On the other hand, a person who's clear-headed and is not prone to imagine all sorts of extraordinarily horrid outcomes can embrace the possibility that all change is change for the better. And furthermore, that things can change back to the way they were before if we don't get in the way by throwing all sorts of negative energy into the space. So the book, When Everything Changes, Change Everything, talks in these terms and explains what I call the mechanics of the mind. It also explains the systems of the soul and how we use soul power and mind power co-jointly to not only negotiate the changes that are now occurring, but to create the changes we would choose to have occur in the days and times to come.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I look forward to that new book and hope to have you back so that we can talk about that again, because it sounds very exciting and I think pretty necessary. And of course, this goes into our fifth point, which is ties in quite nicely, which is about you deciding you are not your story, which we get so caught up in, as you say, the data, what happened, everything, that, you know, we replay our story over and over and it becomes our pattern and we get stuck in it.
One of the most important of the steps to being happier than God is just that. The day that we wake up and realize we are not our story is the day that we become free forever. Now, you would think this would be a fairly simple thing to do, but as a matter of fact, it's one of the biggest challenges faced by human beings, how to get out of their story. We have a story about how life is and who we are in relationship to it, with regard and with respect to every single aspect of the human experience: sexuality, health, religion and God, school and education, parents and parenting, childhood, siblings, friends, money, wealth, occupations, right livelihood, diet, you name it. We got a story about it. And if we live from that story, we create inevitably a distorted reality that bears no relationship whatsoever to what's actually going on and to the ultimate truth. Our opportunity in the community of cultural creatives is to move ahead to the ultimate truth, to the actual truth, to the ultimate reality, and grab information from that source rather than from our past data, and bring that information to bear on the present moment. What's happening here? Why is it happening? Who am I in relationship to what's happening? And how can I bring this ultimate reality to bear on this present moment so that I don't live anymore in a distorted reality? That's what masters do. That's what Jesus did. It's what the Buddha did, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's what the great ancient masters have done. It's what contemporary masters do as well. The Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, and others. Paramahansa Yogananda's wonderful disciple, Kriyananda, and others have shown us the way that it's possible to be in that place, even while on the earth, in this daily frenzy that we have gotten ourselves caught up in. So, yeah, that's just a very powerful step to allow ourselves to notice that we are not our story, to release our story, and to consider the possibility that the ultimate truth lies outside and not inside of our story about ourselves.
Yeah. And the sixth way to be happier than God is to have only preferences. Again, something incredibly difficult to do, because we need to shift from our addictions to preferences, and we tend to be a society that thrives on our addictions.
Especially if we don't understand who we really are vis-a-vis those addictions, if we think that we actually can become addicted to them rather than just pretend that we are. Yeah, that's exactly true. That, you know, an addiction is a child mentality. I need, you know, I come to your house, Neil, would you like to have some ice cream for dessert? And you put out the, yes, I would prefer chocolate if you have it. Well, all I have is vanilla. Well, now a person who merely has preferences says, thank you very much, vanilla would be just fine. I would prefer chocolate, but if you don't have any chocolate in the house, I'm not going to deny myself the enjoyment of ice cream simply because I can't have my preference. On the other hand, a person who's addicted would say, no, you don't understand. I either get chocolate ice cream or I'm not happy here. That's, you can always tell when you're addicted rather than when you simply have a preference, because when you're addicted, the absence of what you're addicted to causes you to be very unhappy. Whereas if you merely have a preference, the absence of what you have a preference for does not cause you to lose your happiness. And that's how you can always tell the difference. So we talk in the book in terms of raising your addictions to simple preferences. And we also talk about how to do that. It's not enough time in this interview,
exactly.
But people who want to know about that might find it interesting to grab a copy of that book.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Number 7, see the perfection.
Well, that is very, very close to my heart. And I was told by God in conversations with God that everything is perfect. And that that comes close to what I was saying a minute ago.
Mm-hmm.
All change is change for the better. And there's no such thing as change for the worse. the process of life demands it, because every change is an announcement that disharmony or dysfunction was present in a certain system, situation, or environment. And that what has to happen is that the system, situation, or the environment must adapt. It must, in fact, change in order to maintain itself as sustainable. And so, in that context, all things that occur in perfection. When we are allowed to see the perfection, when we can embrace that and hold that as our living reality, we can easily be happier than God. Happier than God, of course, being a figure of speech, meaning as happy as you could possibly imagine.
And then some.
And we can be that happy when we see the perfection in everything. Now, here again, hindsight is much better than foresight. Mm-hmm. I can look back at my life and see that so many things that changed that I wish had not changed at the time, that I thought were not any good for me at all at the time, have proven to be perfect, in fact, even though at the time it looked like an utter disaster. So I can see the perfection of my past life. What this little step in the book talks about is taking our past experience and moving it forward to create present wisdom. What makes us think that tomorrow will be any different than yesterday? So if life worked out in a way that produced a perfect outcome in yesterday's moment, it will do the same thing today and tomorrow. So I look at all the changes that have occurred in my life, all the things that have happened, if you will, and honestly, 9/10 of them have turned out just terrifically, even though there might have been some difficulty and some pain involved along the way. And now I've learned that. So now when things happen in my life, I just take a deep breath and go, you know what? I see the perfection here. And in another couple of weeks or another couple of months, it's going to be clear to everybody. But I know that right now it looks like a mess. And everybody breathe and relax. It's going to be all right.
Mm-hmm.
That's what see the perfection means.
And I guess we're always judging everything, including
ourselves.
Of course,
that's where our judged past data comes from.
Mm-hmm. So number 8, bypass the drama. Goes along with judging.
I don't have time to go through all 17.
I know. I think we're not.
but drop the drama is a good one because it is a proclivity of human beings to get caught up in their drama. They get stuck on the line of causality at the space called emotion. And they keep on rerunning that emotion and rerunning it. Like in the old days, a needle getting stuck on a record. That the emotion keeps on running and running and running. And when you're stuck in that place, you get into your drama for sure. So one of the important steps in becoming happier than God is to drop the drama and be able to just have the objectivity to stand back and look at yourself and go, wow, I'm really getting into it here. And stop yourself from doing that. There's a wonderful comedy sketch by the comedian Bob Newhart. And the sketch is called Stop It. And you can watch this sketch, by the way, on...
YouTube?
Yeah, on YouTube. just type in Bob Newhart and look for the sketch called Stop It. It's hilarious. It's about a psychiatrist. He's a psychiatrist in this sketch. And this lady comes in, and she's talking all about her dysfunctional behaviors, all about her dramas, if you please. And he says, "Well, I can help you with that. I can help you with that. I can. I'm glad you came here. I'm going to give you two words of advice now, and you may want to, you know, just listen carefully. And I think this will help you immensely." She said, "Should I write it down?" He said, "No. Most people can remember the words. It's just two words. Stop it." You know, and she says, "That's it? I came here, I'm paying you as a psychiatrist to tell me to stop it." He said, "Yes, just stop it." And then the sketch goes on. It's a very funny sketch, but it has a lot of truth to it, enormous truth to it. All we have to do is just stop it. Stop the drama. Cut it out. You're just making it all up in your mind. And again, I want to say that a couple of years from today, two-thirds, I won't say every single one, but two-thirds of those dramas you're going to laugh at. And you're going to say, I don't know why I made such a big deal about that. Boy, I made a big deal about that when it was happening. And here we are 24 months later, and it's no big deal. Wow. And then we can take that wisdom and move it forward to the future so that when the next big thing comes along and we have a tendency to get into our drama about it, we can simply stop it.
Okay, so I'm going through the number, all of your different 17 to see which ones we can touch on next so that we can try and get the ones that I resonate the most. And I would say, because I think a lot of it's been about self-love, and number 12 is have compassion for yourself.
Well, you know, I can't think of anything more important in the process by which we become happier than God than that. Most people, you know, are very hard on themselves. We have far, far much more compassion for the next person than we do for ourselves. I mean, it's really remarkable that we will extend patience, understanding, compassion, kindness, all of these wonderful attributes to others in far greater quantities than we ever will for ourselves. And to be happier than God, you've got to include yourself on the list of people you love. And you've got to grant yourself the same gifts that you would grant those that you love. You have to act as if you're in love with you, and then give yourself the compassion to notice that maybe you did misstep. Maybe you did fall off the wagon, so to speak. Maybe you did break a commitment that you made to keep on a diet or to be on work on time every day this month, or whatever it is that you're trying to do as you improve the way you are moving through the world. But to have compassion for yourself and to give yourself space for your own humanness and to just accept, yes, that's what happened. And that doesn't mean it can never change. It just means that's what happened now. And then to move on, to love yourself through all of it. Boy, self-love is very healing, and compassion, self-compassion is very healing, to have compassion for yourself. So I've learned there are a lot of ways to do that. You can do some mirror work where you hold a little compact mirror or a little shaving mirror in front of your face and just look at that face in the mirror and say, you know, I love you. You're doing the best you can here. And sometimes you do really, really well. Sometimes maybe not so well. But you know, at the end of the day, you're still a wonderful, glorious, nice, sweet, loving, caring, and ultimately innocent person. Love yourself through that. And allow yourself to embrace that as your reality. And then you can get up the next day and try again. But without that kind of self-compassion, there's no way you'll be done, so done, that you'll just want to really check out. Some people actually physically check out. That is, they end their own lives. Regrettably, God bless them, they actually commit suicide because they don't have the compassion for themselves to embrace themselves in the moments of their deepest, what they would call, failures. Someone once said to me, if you saw you as God sees you, you would smile a lot. And I remembered that from the day it was told to me. So yes, compassion is huge in this list of 17 steps to being happier than God. It's huge. And I've had to learn that and practice that in my life.
You talked a lot about speaking your own truth. And I think, you know, if we are to live authentically, we really need to get out of having to please others, having to, you know, just, I guess, understand who we are more so that we, you know, can really truly be in our truth. And it's just such an important part of why we're here. I mean, it's just, and we are so good at hiding the truth and being afraid of the truth and just not wanting to get there. So it's worth mentioning again because it's just so important.
You know, it's been said, know the truth and the truth will set you free.
Hmm.
And every book I write talks a little bit about that. I can't write a book without mentioning that at least once. We must have the courage and the conviction to explore our own truth, come to know it deeply, then to live it, to express it, to share it, and not to shrink back from it. So that, yes, that is a profoundly important, and it takes enormous courage sometimes, because we're afraid of being abandoned, rejected, made wrong. And yet we have to do what I call stand in our truth. Stand in your truth. Speak your truth, but soothe your words with peace. A wonderful master shared that with me years ago. His name was Futsu Trion. Futsu is a Chinese word. It means master. Master Trion. He was a master of a form of martial arts called Gondogao. And he would look at his students and say, speak your truth, but soothe your words with peace.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
To yourself, by the way, as well as to others, I might add.
Because, you know, we judge ourselves a lot more than others judge us.
Yeah.
Another one is watching our energy. And I like this because you talk about feeling as the language of the soul. And, you know, if we just have to match our energies with what's outside of us and inside of us and find a way to create that resonance.
It's a lot easier than people think if they begin to pay attention to the energies of things around them. You know, everything has energy. You know, we know this, by the way. Nobody does not know this. You go into your closet, you pick out some clothes for the day, get halfway out the closet door, and then say, whoa, this doesn't feel right. I don't think I'll do it. I'm going to wear it. And you totally change clothes before you got three steps from the closet. And then you might even do it twice. And meanwhile, you know, your spouse is waiting downstairs. Are you coming? So we all know what it's like to deal with that kind of energy. And energy is either resonant with us or it's not. That's what causes us to change our shirt or our blouse three times. So it causes us to decide that on Monday it's perfectly fine to have a piece of lemon meringue pie, but on Tuesday, in fact, it doesn't feel right. So it causes us to have instant feelings about people. We meet a person, and we either, you know, take to them, as they say, or we don't. We even get sometimes a pushback from them for no reason that's immediately apparent, just an energy field. Everything is energy. And if you attune yourself to the process by which we become aware of that energy, you become very sensitized to it. You can literally walk into a room and feel the air. And sometimes the air can be so thick you can cut it with a knife. And other times the air can be so warm and embracing that you just melt right into it. So what we're talking about in this particular point is to sensitize yourself to the energies of everything around you, the food, the clothing, the color, the sounds, the music, the images of your mind and the images you bring to your mind through television and movies and magazines and whatever, to tune into the energy of everything and let yourself do that deliberately and intentionally. It's amazing, you know, really, you can walk through a cafeteria line and literally wave your hand slowly. Don't touch the food, but, you know, about 6 or 10 inches from the food, and wave your hand slowly over the food, and your hand will tell you when you become attuned to it what food is welcome in your body right now and what is not. And, by the way, it might shock you because it may not match up with the diet you think you're supposed to be on.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you may be a vegetarian and your body's saying it's okay to eat this piece of fish or chicken right now. And sometimes your body will say no. And to use an example, you can literally scan your own body, for that matter, or scan the body of another, and begin to see where there's an out, where there's a disharmony, where there's something where the energy isn't matching. And finally, you can begin to match your energy with the energy that's in the space that you currently occupy. It's possible to do that, and masters have done it, and even learning students have done it. And that's why it's one of those steps that are in that wonderful book, How to Be Happier Than God, because it talks about becoming aware and becoming attuned to the energy of the moment and shifting our energy so that it is in a place of greater harmony with the energy of the moment, thus to produce the outcome we would choose and desire. And you know, speaking of outcomes, I'm out of time.
Well, it was a great pleasure having you this evening, and I assume that a lot of people are going to have to get this book because we didn't get through the 17, but it was a great pleasure having you, and I really enjoyed it, and I hope to have you back.
Thank you. It was lovely to be here with you, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Take care.